Welcome back to Sound Advice, the podcast where we explore solutions for leaders to create a better workplace, brought to you by Life Health Solutions. I'm your host, Linda Mzamane. Today, we're talking about uncertainty. More specifically, how an unpredictable economy and financial fluctuations in a business can impact talent retention and employee engagement. And importantly, what leaders can do about it. Employee disengagement cost the world economy $438 billion in 2024. That's over 7 trillion rand. We know that engaged employees produce better outcomes than disengaged employees, which is, of course, better for the bottom line. But what happens when the world feels shaky? What can businesses do to keep their teams engaged, satisfied, and safe in an ever-changing environment? Our two guests will know something about this, how to help organizations with strategy and development when it comes to their people. First, we'll be joined by John Mullins, an organizational development practitioner with over 20 years' experience in various consulting and management roles. We'll also hear from Lauren Cullum, a senior director and human resources business partner. And while this podcast is called Sound Advice, we'll also throw in our usual Bad Advice segment, where we share some truly terrible wisdom our guests have heard. But first, I'm talking to John Mullins, an organizational development practitioner. John has over 20 years' experience in various consulting and management roles in both private and public sectors. He has a stellar track record in facilitating leadership development, organizational change management, employee engagement, and building corporate culture. Thanks for joining us today, John.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
John, you have been in this space for a few decades, so you must have seen some wild things. What has changed since you started as an HR consultant in the 90s?
Yeah, thanks for the reminder of so many decades. I don't know whether to take that as a compliment or not. You're right, it has been wild. You know, the most obvious tangible things would be just the arrival of technology in the workplace. And despite the fact that in those days, organizations were in some ways more social, there was more reliance on social connectivity to get things done. Interestingly enough, there was also very hectic social policies, you know, like controlling policies. That's where I see most of the changes. I remember smoking was allowed in offices.
Do you remember those days?
you'd arrive in your manager's office and it'd be this haze of smoke, and dress code policies, managing time, etc. All those things were like really designed around social control.
Yeah.
If I had to summarize, I'd say the biggest change I've seen between then and now is actually belief. We weren't short of ideas back then around how we should improve workplaces. We weren't short of these crazy ideas, but I think there was this kind of underlying disbelief that we couldn't get it done. We would never get it right because there was so much control. Mm. Organizations had been built on mindsets that were 100 years old. What I'm seeing now is a much greater sense of belief that, you know, we can evolve and we can change the workplace. At this stage of my career, you know, I no longer have to like beat myself up to go and, you know, get leaders to engage in conversation. There's almost this driving feeling of like, we need to change things. I started my career at a big corporate. In 1996, we were already rolling out EQ training from Daniel Goleman's seminal work on emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
So it's not like EQ just suddenly arrived on our doorsteps. Now everybody talks about it. It was there already, but I just think that that disbelief that that would actually make a difference. And then the other one that stood out for me was self-management, self-managing teams. We were researching Disney Corporation because they were the innovators. They were doing some interesting things. And we were trying to bring this into corporate South Africa. These guys thought we were like totally crazy.
Yeah, I like that. And thank goodness there's been an evolution in that space. And is it more like the ability to challenge the status quo as well, I imagine?
Yeah, 100%.
Employee engagement on a global scale fell in 2024 at levels equal to the decline that we experienced during the COVID-19 lockdown. Why do you think this is?
I think there are probably two things worth speaking about. We're at that time in organizational life where we're seeing a much greater influx of a completely new generation of employee with completely different mindsets. When I joked around about technology arriving in the 90s and quite literally PCs arriving on desktops and that for the first time, we're talking about generations that were born into technology. They don't know any different. In South Africa, 1994 was the arrival of cell phones. You know, it was crazy. You'd walk around and you'd have a cell phone and you'd wait for somebody to call you just so you could look cool, you know, like, but
open
now
your
it's
flip
like,
phone.
Yeah, it changes perspectives and it changes mindset. And I think the work needs to mean something different to people. What I'm seeing is a far greater emphasis on purpose and meaning in the work we do versus I work because I need to have a job in order to provide for something. It's now a case of if I don't find the purpose and meaning that I'm looking for, then this is not worth sticking around for. This is what I think COVID did for us, is it did force the entire world to rethink the way we did work, because we all had to work from home. We all had to be distant from each other. And in reaction, we would just have to get it done and try and make it work. And while you might have some leaders who looked at that and said, hang on, this is a great catalyst for some long-lasting change here, others were like, okay, let's just get through this. You know, let's just get over this difficulty.
Yeah.
But the problem is that every employee experienced a new work life. The cat's out the bag then, and it's like, okay, hang on, now we're trying to shove everything back in. And I think the organizations that are struggling with engagement are the ones that are trying to sort of go back to something that they remember, as opposed to, you know, using this as a launch pad for a longer lasting change, a new kind of, normal. So for me, engagement levels are dropping because they know there's something better. They know there has to be meaning in it. And I think organizations are not fast enough to respond to that.
You've worked with both startups and with corporates. Do they mostly have the same challenges when it comes to employee engagement, or are there differences or nuances there?
Fundamentally, at its core, I think the similarities for me are that we're talking about people, right?
Mm.
It's the employee experience that actually impacts on the engagement levels. Whenever a leader comes and says he wants to build a high-performing culture, then I say, okay, so let's work the equation backwards. Highly engaged employees are going to drive that high performance, but what drives high engagement? And that is your employee experience.
Mm.
Employee experience, that's a reflection of your culture. We try and sort of simplify the equation. So for me, a corporate struggles with the idea that you would walk in there and there would be this history, the way we do things around here. And so it actually almost becomes too complex to now try and change all of that, because we just keep ourselves completely busy all day trying to undo many different policies that were written many years ago. Corporates are slow to change.
Mm.
But on the other side, startup energy, it's almost like employees that work in startups, they're naturally drawn to the startup in a way, because it is hustle and fast and it's good energy and you get exposure. You don't have all these rules and we can almost rewrite everything from the start. We don't have this history. The challenge there for me is we find that there are lower levels of EQ in startups.
Okay.
Because everything is about the delivery at the expense of the hours we work. And so you have people in startups who are prone to burnout because leadership are not as skilled in managing the employee.
You also founded a consultancy. How did this experience as the employer change your understanding, if at all, of what a business needs for someone in your role?
It's, for me, all about never wanting to be a manager. I was kind of dead set against this idea that if I was going to manage people or be in a position where I had people working around me or for me, I would never want to be this idea of a manager. And I always felt like if I could become a better leader to these folks, they would become more self-managed.
Mm-hmm.
What I discovered was as you add another person to the team, it already adds more complexity. So you just now have more people to communicate with and you've got to make sure you're covering all the bases, and messages tend to get a bit lost in conversation because it was easier when I only had one person to talk to. Now I've got three, and you can get quite drawn into that complexity. Rather use influence and direction and principles to create an environment where people around you can actually get on with the work.
Mm.
You bring people onto a team for a reason. You believe they're the best. You believe they're capable. Just setting the right principles, the right direction is enough. I take a similar message to leaders that I work with, is don't try and overmanage. Forget management. Just lead. Lead by example on a behavioral and character side, but create an environment where those folks are going to thrive. And that just needs a bit of guidance. And guidance is about follow principles,
yeah.
You know, show a bit of support and care, but don't overmanage. So I'm a bit of a anti-management kind of individual, but I think there's times for managing work and leading people, and we mustn't confuse those two things.
I love that distinction. And I think there are many leaders out there for whom that is one and the same thing. Leading is managing, but that's a great nuance and a distinction to make there. When salary increases or bonuses aren't possible because, you know, budgets are tight and business and the economy is what it is, what other recognition and rewards programs have you found most effective in keeping employees motivated?
The conventional thinking around this would be applying something like a total reward model, which is to look at reward more than just salary. I do think it's still very core. For me, being honest about what we can afford and at the same time, from an investment point of view, don't always see people as a cost to the business, see them as an investment. And I mean, I think we have a duty almost to grow people. And those that feel it in your own organization will probably stick around. Well-being is a massive factor. I think this idea that well-being is important And I tend to have a kind of an athlete's mindset to this. When you look at elite athletes, you know, the amount of rest time, the amount of recovery time is just as essential as the training time and the hard work time. Business isn't sport, but at the same time, there are lessons there around, you know, look at each employee and treat them like with this elite mindset, elite athlete mindset, where, you know, the amount of rest they get, the amount of well-being they experience is important.
Mm.
In one organization, we removed our leave cap. We said, we don't want you to feel like there's a hard limit on your leave. And we rather managed the norms. We said, okay, how much leave are people actually taking? And started to focus on the real intention of leave. The leave didn't blow out. There was no abuse, really. Norms stayed pretty stable. And then we introduced something called a My Day Friday. It's a work on yourself day. And one Friday every month, employees could take that day and do whatever they wanted to do on that day. If you want to go have tea with your grandmother, you can go do that. If you wanted to go hike up the mountain, you could go do that. If you wanted to do a webinar that you had been dying to do, you know, in work time, you could do that. And the whole purpose of that was, A, to give people that space, that breather to say, okay, this is going to bring something new to me. But also everybody was doing it at the same time, which meant I didn't come back after a day off and have 100 emails, you know, that I had to deal with. When we talk about building creative rewards and recognition, you've got to start thinking it from the perspective of what's going to grow this person's value. And yes, salary is critical, and we'd like to make sure we match that from the value in the market point of view. But sometimes organizations can't give 20% increases in bonuses. So make sure you're balancing that with some other real investments in people.
I think that's very refreshing. I think organizations that take those things into account and also consider the fact that work and life are one and the same. It's not like work is separate from life. Life is happening while we're working.
Goes back to your first question about what's different between the 90s and now. The 90s, yes. It was very much, look here, don't bring your personal life into the workplace.
So what long-term strategies can help an organization to consistently attract and keep top talent?
I could talk for hours on this point alone. One thing that I'm practicing more and more and introducing to any of the teams that I work with is culture is your product. Stop acting like a manager with respect to the HR profession. Don't think from an HR mindset about culture. Think as a product owner. You sort of look at your product and you go, if culture is my product, then who are my users? Who are my consumers of that culture? And it's your employees, right?
Yeah.
You have to now get to know your employees a lot better. That's a kind of a framework already to be able to go in and say what needs to change here. So culture change is a long-term strategy by nature, but I do think it starts with that real key shift of don't see culture as only a leader's responsibility or it's an HR thing that needs to happen. At the end of the day, companies in a true sense of a product who learn best are the ones that are engaging with their clients more. They almost democratize their product in a way. You know, they put it out there on social media. They talk about it. They say, look what our customers are doing with our product. And I think that if you apply that in the workplace, you'll start finding clues to how to fix things on a much more longer term basis.
Can you share an example of a time that you successfully navigated financial instability and kept employees engaged through that process?
You know, having worked with a tech business, particularly during lockdown, COVID, and then just post-COVID, there was this immediate realization that suddenly our talent is open season globally now because of remote work. And we were like kind of shocked into action in the sense that, you know, guys were coming to us and saying, hey, man, look, I don't want to leave, but I've been offered the salary and it's in dollars. And if I convert that, it's like triple my salary. And we'd be like, man, you know, we're already paying you at the highest end of like what the South African market would be.
How do we compete?
Like, how do we even get close to that? And it was impossible. We just didn't have the budget to retain talent in the way that it was being poached. I remember sitting down with our CEO at the time and saying, look here, we can go on the defensive. You know, we can say all the bad things about these other companies and that. But when we looked at their offers, we were like jaw-dropping. You know, man, these guys are getting $2,000 learning allowances. They're getting international holiday travel things. And it was just all these incredible benefits. And we were thinking, okay, we can't go on the defensive on those things, right? We're just going to get beaten up. So let's go on the offensive. We try to build a culture that people would feel proud of and people would feel engaged with. And so what we ended up doing is we started with the one thing we could control immediately, and that was our leadership approach. We ended up talking about simple things like showing humility and kindness and honesty to our staff. And so as an intervention, in a tech sense, we use like Slack as a direct messaging platform, and we created channels. And one of those channels was called Candid Conversations. instead of trying to figure out all the solutions by ourselves, we opened up our conversations to our staff and we said, okay, let's talk honestly and openly, and we allowed these candid conversations to unfold. I mean, at times it was pretty scary to see what people would be asking. And,
I can imagine.
But taking a deep breath as leaders and saying, okay, we're not going to get defensive about that either. We're not going to try and give answers where we didn't have the answers. We're going to just be honest, and we built kindness into our core values. And that experience of building a workplace where people were being treated as adults and people and had a voice, and suddenly the retention levels rose up again.
Mm.
But yeah, I think transparency, regular feedback, telling people where the business is at, not hiding behind the fact that the business was not necessarily doing as well as we'd like it to do. All that level of transparency and honesty helped a lot. We built a principle in around good stewardship, you know, collectively. Let us all be good stewards of our resources, because there is waste. There's always going to be waste somewhere. And so by all playing our parts, I think we built a strength against the difficulties and the uncertainties.
Mm. Mm. I love the candid conversations. There was a phrase I recently came across called radical candor, which speaks to exactly that, where people and organizations are encouraged to speak openly, directly to leadership. And it really does have some amazing impact down the line.
We absolutely bought into the idea of the radical candor model. Kim Scott's work on radical candor talks about this. We use different language with it, because what we were also discovering is that very much in the startup sense, there were leaders that were almost weaponizing feedback, okay, because they were using the word radical candor. Meant I could say things very hard and very cutthroat almost in a way. So we started to develop more of a language around fearless feedback.
I'm just so excited about where the future of work is headed when we think about all these concepts and what these new generations are going to be looking for and hold valuable and important in workplaces. Thank you so much for your insights, John. Before you go, we'd love to hear about some of the worst advice you've ever received in our Bad Advice segment.
That's bad advice.
Joining us for this segment is our other guest, Lauren Cullum, a senior director of HR. Welcome, Lauren.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Linda.
Hi. Such a pleasure. We're glad you're here. So in your careers, you are holding people's livelihoods in your hands. A poorly chosen word can end up with dire consequences. What have you heard a leader say? Maybe it was early on, maybe it was more recent, that turned out to be misguided. Let's start with you, John.
Not throwing any of the leaders I've worked with under the bus here.
Don't throw anyone under the bus. No names.
No names. Probably two things that have been long lasting that have, at the time, maybe it might have sounded like good advice, but actually became really bad advice, was don't show vulnerability as a manager. Always be the smartest person in the room, essentially. And vulnerability is weakness. And you can't be weak as a manager. I think about that a lot. And, you know, there was a time the world was very different where we had to have these like really strong male toxic kind of leaders that we would call now, because, you know, that's essentially how it was in the workplace. You just had to be right all the time. And I feel like that was really terrible advice, as it's been proven that leaders who are more vulnerable, more honest about not knowing everything, are the ones that are succeeding more now than ever. And then one other one was probably a little closer to home for me, which is don't question authority. Maybe it's because I was just being too rebellious. I always felt like I was swimming in the wrong direction, but don't question authority. Organizations are built on hierarchies for a reason. You know, there's a chain of command and you've got to follow these rules. The problem with that is it doesn't really do anything for continuous improvement. It doesn't do a lot for evolution of the workplace. So without using the, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. I'd like to say that testing authority or questioning assumptions is actually a good thing. So the bad advice is don't question authority. I would say, nah, that's a bit old school thinking. You know, rather question the assumptions that the authority comes with, because you might just find that not everybody's right in management.
And how about you, Lauren? What did someone tell you thinking it would be a pearl of wisdom when it actually was the opposite?
So I also had to take my brain to think about this and casted my mind back to earlier years in my career. In a similar vein of what you shared, John, I'm sure we've all heard this, if it's not broken, don't fix it. I've literally heard a leader say years ago, I just want to underscore that part, that they don't pay their team to think, they pay their team to do. And this goes against one of my primary work philosophies or principles, which is apply your mind. Apply your mind, have a view, let's work through your thought, think about the situation and don't just accept things for the way that they are. We can't continue to just accept things the way that they are. with all the disruption and volatility that we experience as organizations operating in this world. So Santosh, don't pay your team members to think, pay them to do, which I don't think there's an appetite for that anymore.
Sure. No, definitely not. Sure. But thanks again, both of you, for sharing these stories with us. John, we'll say goodbye now as we explore the topic further with Lauren. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks very much. Take care.
Life Health Solutions can facilitate customized, confidential coaching sessions with middle, senior, and executive level managers. These sessions can help develop them into high-functioning, effective teams and unlock their leadership potential. Methodologies firmly grounded in neuroscience help individuals and teams become agile and high-performing units, taking your business to the next level of success. Tap on the link in the show notes for more. Lauren is a Senior Director of Human Resources at 2U, which is a global player in education technology. With certifications in confronting bias and inclusive leadership, Lauren is passionate about building a diverse and equitable workforce. In her work, she also fulfills the role of Human Resources Business Partner, where she acts as a strategic partner in aligning HR practices with her organization's goals and objectives. Thanks for joining us today, Lauren.
So awesome to be here, Nanda. Thank you.
You joined 2U in 2018 and have been there almost 7 years. It's been a pretty eventful 7 years in the world. Do you think there's a better understanding now of the value that HR professionals can bring to an organization?
Eventful feels like an understatement, Linda. It's been wild.
Sure it is. Wild.
The world has changed so much and so has HR. I've been fortunate to work in a progressive HR environment where we're not seen just as executors, to strategic partners. And I think there's a growing understanding now that HR isn't just paper pushes or dealing with employee problems and updating policies. It's truly about helping organizations navigate complexity, scale culture, and balance the very real tension between a thriving business and a thriving employee experience. We don't need to stretch our minds to understand that those two concepts could be at contention with one another. Employee experience sounds expensive and a business just wants to be successful. I believe HR is uniquely positioned to surface the paradox or the perceived paradox early and hold space for both perspectives and really influence decisions upfront so we don't need to deal with major problems downstream. And from my perspective, I think that's where the impact lies.
Definitely. What would you say is the current frame of mind of employees right now across South Africa, if you were to describe it?
I mean, not only in South Africa, we live in a truly globalized world.
True.
And if we zoom out, the world feels volatile economically, politically, socially, and that uncertainty absolutely shows up in the workplace. I think it varies by industry, role, location, and generation. But I think most employees today are driven by a few core priorities. First, the need for financial security for themselves and the lifestyle that they want to build. Second, I think, is a desire for flexibility to manage both work and life in a way that feels sustainable. But beneath that, there's an undercurrent of needing reassurance that their job is stable and that the organization has a plan and that they're not walking into an unknown every day. We've needed to deal with a lot of industries that have been hit by rounds and rounds of layoffs. And so employees come to work and they do want to know, like, do I have a job? Am I secure? Is this a real thing? Is this a long-term thing? Or do I need to be thinking about other plans?
Certainly, yeah. And it's difficult as an employee to kind of do your best work under circumstances like that. So we can easily list many of the obvious challenges that negatively impact employee engagement. What's an issue that you think most leaders underestimate or are less aware of?
Well, I think we can all accept that change is constant. From what I've seen, one of the most underestimated threats to engagement is how change is communicated. Our leaders are really good at explaining what is changing or why it needs to happen. But where they fall short is explaining what the change actually means for the individual. This is basic change management 101, but I'm sure if each of us were listening to change that's going to impact us, our only question would be, what does this mean for me? And if that is not going to be answered, it creates a sense of threat. And when people feel uncertain or safe, they shift into self-protection mode, as we all do, where you're likely to see the worst of someone and not the most engaged. So I don't think it's just about the messaging. It's about helping people find their place in the change.
And true, articulating it down to the individual level is really what will make or break that kind of communication.
Sure.
So how can leaders work better with the finance and human resources teams to communicate the financial realities to employees without causing more stress than is necessary? If you have some practical examples, please share as well.
My stance is really simple. I think information is empowering and people are not stupid. If we could hold those two concepts together. From my experience, it's far more respectful and impactful to be transparent about financial realities than to try and protect people through silence or spin. When employees understand how the business is performing, they're better able to connect the dots when tough decisions need to be made. It builds trust even when the news isn't easy. People handle difficult information better than being blindsided. And being blindsided erodes the trust that individuals have in leadership and the direction of where the company is going. I was saying earlier, but especially in the tech space over the last couple of years, globally and in South Africa, there have been multiple rounds of layoffs. If someone has a sense that their role may be at risk and they know this, they can start networking, upskilling, looking for their next opportunity proactively. And that's hard. Like, I'm not saying that to diminish that the circumstances are not ideal or that this is not challenging or difficult. But you can find empowerment through the challenge, and that is the redeeming factor in all of this. Practically, I think that this means HR and finance should work closely to align on what to share, when to share it, and how to frame it. You need to help people understand what it means in real human terms. Another gap that I've seen is managers not being equipped to have these conversations and creating space for Q&A so people can process whatever the realities are. My stance is that transparency doesn't create fear. I think uncertainty creates the fear.
And I think also leaders should remember that solutions can sometimes come from the most unexpected places. So having that level of transparency could be a path to solution as well.
100%.
How does economic uncertainty impact efforts towards more diverse, equitable, and inclusive workforces?
For me, a diverse, equitable, and inclusive workforce is not just a budget line item. Yes, budget is lovely and we need money to do things, but diversity, equity, and inclusion, for it to have a true impact, it's really about being embedded in how you operate as an organization, not just the initiatives that you run. So in times of economic uncertainty, the risk is that DE&I gets deprioritized or treated as something extra. But if it's truly embedded and baked into how your organization thinks about talent attraction, retention, and development, then it's not something we pause when things get tight, because it's part of how we operate. I think the real question is DE&I embedded in our ways of working? And if not, what needs to change for it to be? Because in uncertain times, inclusive culture is foregrounded and it's not a nice to have. Having an inclusive culture is what helps to have people feel seen, valued, and willing to stay and contribute through those tough times.
It's one of those things where a mind shift is almost required in organizational leadership to kind of make sure that DEI and things like that are not the first to go when it's time to look at budget cuts and things. They are an integral part of how the organization moves forward. So in terms of global trends, like those that are happening to diversity programs in the US, how do they impact us here in South Africa?
So in South Africa, we have our own employment equity framework, which is specifically designed to drive transformation in the workplace. But it would be naive to think that global trends, especially when it's happening in the US, which has a big influence on where we are globally, doesn't have an influence here. I've seen how shifts in the global narrative can give certain individuals or companies a reason to divest from DE&I. But at the same time, I've also seen organizations that have held firm in their commitment to inclusion, regardless of the political climate elsewhere. For me, it comes back to the question around whether DE&I is truly embedded in how a company operates. There's a strong belief that diversity is better. Having diversity on your team of product solutions will get you a better product at the end of the day. It's better for business. Having diversity in your marketing teams will allow your product to be marketed in a way that it wouldn't be if it was just sort of homogeneous in terms of ways of thinking or demographic diversity. And so it is a core belief that diversity is better for business. I think everything else that is happening kind of becomes a bit irrelevant because we need it to keep up for the disruption that we continually need to face. We need it to have the edge. Yeah, that goes from diversity that you can't see. So people just thinking differently to diversity that you can see. People coming from different points of view, different races, cultures, languages, abilities. So I think if you are working with people where the philosophy is that it is better for business, the rest is kind of not as important.
Let's shift a bit now and talk skills development. When employees are facing an uncertain future, especially with all this talk about AI and the fears around it replacing jobs, how can skills development help in this area?
I love this question. I liken myself to a continuous learner, and so I'm always trying to upskill myself because I think skills development is one of the most powerful tools we have to face an uncertain future. With AI definitely reshaping how we work, it's not just about learning new tech. It's about building adaptability, critical thinking, and the confidence to navigate the change. The jobs of tomorrow will still need deeply human skills, emotional intelligence, creativity, collaboration. When we invest in learning, we're not just preparing people for new roles, we're helping them stay relevant, resilient, and ready to grow. And this just isn't on individuals. I think companies also need to create spaces for ongoing learning. In a world of constant disruption, skills development isn't a nice to have. You need it in order to survive.
Could you share a specific example of a time you successfully navigated a period of financial instability and kept employee engagement high at the same time?
Linda, I thought this was a bit of a trick question because financial instability and high engagement really go hand in hand unless you are really intentional. In my experience, navigating layoffs and organizational bankruptcy and periods of broad instability, the real drivers of engagement have been transparency, trust, and a clear path forward. One of the key lessons that I've learned is that people don't expect perfect answers, but they do expect and appreciate honesty. I've had influence not just over the message, but also how, when, and when to communicate the messaging, especially during or specifically during an org design change. Being thoughtful about the sequencing of information, who hears what first, how managers are equipped to hold spaces for questions, and what the overall narrative is, can make or break engagement. What garners the most trust into or buy-in into a process is someone feeling like they are important enough to be communicated to in a constructive way versus being told that this is the way things are and off we go. When people understand the why behind the changes and they see that there's a plan to move forward, they're more likely to stay connected, even if the future feels uncertain. Creating a space for two-way dialogue is, I think, really important. Regular check-ins, feedback loops, and visible leadership presence. And so I think through what I share there, it's quite clear that it's not just being spoken to, it's being engaged with that creates the purpose in the communication.
There is something to be learned from the how of communication. And I love what you say about correct timings and who first and that kind of thing, because it does really impact how it's received and the outcome at the end of the day.
For sure.
Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today and being generous with your time. You've given us a lot to think about. So thank you very much.
That's been my pleasure. Thanks, Linda.
Not only have John and Lauren helped us to understand the triggers for employees when it comes to feeling satisfied and energized at work, but they've also given valuable insights on how to be better prepared as leaders for anything the world throws at us. When it comes to building resilient businesses, looking after the people is non-negotiable. So what's the one insight you're going to share with a colleague after listening to our conversation today? For me, a couple of things stood out. What John shared about some of the biggest changes in the work environment over the years is the fact that employees now have the belief that things can change. Also, the fact that salary is not the driver anymore. People want to find purpose and meaning in their work. What Lauren said about transparency also stood out to me. The fact that transparency isn't what creates fear. In fact, it's uncertainty that does just that. And the fact that as leaders, how you communicate the message, the timing, who delivers the message is just as important. And the fact that your communication needs to be clear, it needs to be consistent, and it needs to be human. Those were my biggest takeouts. I'm Linda Mzamane. This has been the Sound Advice podcast brought to you by Life Health Solutions. So if you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast so that you don't miss any upcoming episodes. For more information and helpful resources, please check the show notes. Until next time.